Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to Achtung Wall, broadcasting from the beautiful South Birmingham. Accept no substitute.
Huge welcome, listeners, to a very special edition of Achtung Wall. I've got one of my favourite guests back again for your entertainment. A boyhood hero. It's very strange to be speaking to your boyhood heroes. I never quite get over it. It's Mr. Brian King, the man who was in goal on the very first Mill game I ever went to. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks, Nick, and nice to speak to you again.
Absolutely. Now, as I said, you were in gold. I remember the game well. Mill versus Portsmouth, 1972. We were on a run into what we were hoping were going to be promotion that season. And there you were in goal in front of 22,000 people. Does it still seem recent to you, Brian, after all these years?
I wish I was still playing. But, yeah. You know, I could think of that season, and I can think of my whole life at Millwall. I mean, you know, the moment I was playing for Chelmsford City.
Yeah.
And, well, before then, Stansted, and then on to Chelmsford City, and meeting so many old pro players at that time, you know, players who played in the higher leagues who were then on the way, you know, getting over their 30s and whatever, but were great knowledge and great footballers they've been and were still good footballers at that level.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason we're speaking today, listeners, is that Brian has produced his biography, or I don't know if it's an autobiography or biography. I don't get hung up on these things. It's a book of your life, especially focused at Millwall, Brian. The Lion's King is the title of the book.
I think I've always had that surname, which seemed to please a few journalists, because king of this and king of that. As I say, when I've been going around, or when I have to check in a hotel or meet anybody, they always go name and I go King. They look at me and, surname only.
Absolutely. It's a headline writer's dream, isn't it? The Lion's King is the title of a new book. Brian's story at Millwall and internationally too, Brian. 1967 to 75, 339 appearances for the Lions. You are, in my opinion, a club legend. You are one of the major figures of Mill history. And this is a story of your time at the Den, and it's available by a website called www.littlehellbooks. Little Hell Books, that's all one word, littlehellbooks.com, 1999 on there. It's a fantastic looking cover, Brian. I was just looking at it before we started speaking today. You've got wonderful images of yourself on, you know, these kind of classic images of you at the Den back in those old days, the green shirts. You were a young boy from Chelmsford when you first came to the Den. I mean, what did it seem like?
I can assure you, when I realised at that time that it was after a thing called the Essex Professional Cup Final, which in those days, everybody within all the clubs in Essex, you know, and that's West Ham and Colchester and...
Yeah, Southend, I guess, yeah.
Ourselves, Brentwood and... You know, all these teams entered it. And this particular year, we got through to the final. We lost to Southend on a two-legged final. But after the game, our manager, Harry Ferrier was a great player in his time with Portsmouth when they won the league. I think 2 years in the end of the 50s, I think. He came up and said to me that the that there were two or three clubs looking at myself, and also a central defender who played for us called Peter Collins.
Right.
Peter eventually went on to play for Tottenham. And I was told that Spurs and Millwall were interested in me, along with, I think, Portsmouth at the time and Cardiff and Newcastle, I think. And I thought, well, I've seen it before. I've heard it before. I'm 18 years old and not for 19 now. And always wanted to be a pro footballer. I've been working as an apprentice electrician.
Well, that's going to be one of my questions. I mean, had you always wanted to play professional football? And
From the time I was finishing school. And, you know, we have a little bit in the book about that. And, you know, you go to, I think they're called career officers today.
Yes, they are, yeah.
where some bloke come from head office, the schools of Essex or whatever.
Yeah.
Sat down with me and he said, I left school on the 15th of April, 1962. That's three days before my 15th birthday, actually.
Oh, you left school at 15, Brian?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I was very naughty at school, actually.
You got to tell us, come on.
when I was 11, we had a thing called the 11 plus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my mum said, and my mum was quite pleased. I'd say I was ultra clever, but I was, you know.
You were bright, yeah.
What was said, I listened to, and it seemed to store quite easy.
Okay.
I failed 11 plus.
Did you?
And I failed it on purpose. The school I would have gone to, my mother was in bits, by the way. I thought you was clever than that. I thought
and you were clever than that as well. That was a thing. Wasn't it?
And I looked at my dad and he winked at me and I thought, well, he knows and all. And it was because the grammar school I'd have gone to, they played mostly cricket, rugby, and hockey.
Traditional sports for that level of school.
Yeah. And the secondary school I knew played in the league, which was the Bishop Stortford District League,
right,
which incorporated schools from Hertfordshire and Essex.
Right.
So I'm thinking that maybe if I can get in that team,
that's quite a shrewd assessment of your life's course at the age of 11, Brian, isn't it? You knew what you wanted.
Well, I moved to Stansted Secondary School, which was, instead of a 25-minute trip on a bus, jump on your bicycle and you're there in 5 minutes. Again, I was there, about 12-year-old, when I got in there. I got in the under-14s team when I was 12.
Were you always a goalkeeper, or did you?
Yeah, always.
Never played outfield or any other positions.
I played outfield when we were in training or whatever. But no, my heroes at the time was a fella called Nigel Sims at Aston Villa. Harry Gregg.
Yes, famous name. Yeah,
Colin McDonald and these kind of people. Colin McDonald's Burnley in England. I'd always fancied the goalkeeper a bit.
Right.
And on a Sunday, we used to go up on a recreation ground quite near to where we lived. And I always used to go in goal. I mean, there was like men up there, you know. All the lads used to go up there before they went down the pub.
Right.
And they used to stick me in goal and they'd play 10 against 10 with one goal, you know.
How old would you have been at that age doing that kind of football?
Oh, 13, 14.
Right.
Okay. I mean, they were hammering shots at me and I used to get in the way of them. And I can remember a couple of lads who passed away, sadly, now, but they used to go, he's daft enough to be a good goal for him.
You know? Streak of madness.
You know, because I used to get in. I used to come home covered in mud.
I imagine that would have been physically quite demanding on a 13-year-old boy, Brian. I mean, that was...
It was a leather ball as well, you know.
Yeah.
It used to get quite heavy. But I used to love it. I mean, I really loved it. And at that time, when I was progressing through school, I represented the county at athletics.
Right.
At cricket. And also, I won a bad tennis player.
So you're a sporting individual generally, and you just love the. And I suppose it makes being an electrician, Brian, doesn't it? I mean, you know.
Well, you know, I work with some. I tell you what, I work with some great blokes. I mean, and as much as anything, as much as my mum and dad helped me, and my dear old uncle Tom and my nan, I mean, these blokes realised that when I joined Chelmsford City, it was going to be tough with the travelling. And the work, but they helped me as much as they could. One had a scooter where I was working with, one of the old Lambretta scooters, another one had a motorbike, and another one had a car. I mean, they used to get me down at the bus station. It'd be a long day. I'd cycle to work to get a van about 6 o'clock in the morning from Stansted, 3 miles, rain, sun, whatever. I'd get there on the van to Arlow.
Right.
I'd do a day's work, or if I was, as I got older and further up the apprentice ladder, and also further up the Chelmsford City ladder, I was required to play football a bit more. But the head of the Eastern Electricity Board realised that I was going to be playing probably semi-professional,
right?
And I'd need some time off, and he said to me, "I don't mind you." Leaving early, but you have to play for our district team.
he wanted to win his cup, didn't he?
Well, I said, well, okay, that's a fair deal. But the worst thing, well, we got through to the national final, which was at Watford Football Ground.
Yeah.
And I couldn't play because I was playing in Chelmsford City's team.
So it was no good at all.
No, it was a wonderful learning curve, you know, but this, I used to go 3-4 times a week to Chelmsford. I used to get up at 5, breakfast on the old bike, into Bishop Stortford, the van into Ireland. Now, whoever I worked with when I got there, sometimes I went with them on the scooter or the motorbike or the car.
Yeah.
I'd always make sure I got to the bus station to go to Chelmsford, where I'd have just over an hour on the bus, get to Chelmsford, do my training.
Wow.
And I'd have to make the Upper Nine bus back. Otherwise, it was walking and thumbing and lift.
You must have been shattered at the end of the day, Brian. I must say, that sounds physically very demanding.
As I say, I was hungry for it. You know, I wanted to be a footballer. And this is the way it was going to be. And I used to get home about 11 o'clock at night. I'd have my tea, my mum would have my tea ready.
Yeah.
Bed and up again. And
back at it. Yeah.
Achtung, Millwall.
The electric board's loss was Millwall's gain. I know that much, Brian. You know, you were a great goalkeeper. I mean, I know it must be hard to listen to flattery, but you know, your career in the game was wonderful. And I'm just reading the blurb of the book that you brought out here. You know, you saw international duty with Sir Alf Ramsey. The blurb mentions that you'd met Gordon Banks. And the great Russian goalkeeper Lev Yashin too.
Yeah, I met him when I was 16.
Did you? What were the circumstances of you meeting Yashin? And he was a major name.
Brief. It was very brief. But there is actually a YouTube bit from England versus the rest of the world in 1963.
Right. Yes, I remember that. Well, I've read the fixture. Yeah.
Yeah, because when I was 15, and I played for. I played for Hertfordshire. I could play for Hertfordshire or Essex. Anyway, I got picked to play for Hertfordshire. And there was another goalkeeper there as well. And we were then selected for the South against the North for a school board trial.
Right.
Anyway, it was a Birmingham City ground. And, you know, great experience and whatever. But I never made the final squad that was going to play at Wembley against Wales and West Germany and all this. But the following year, I got a letter from the FA through Stansted Football Club, really.
Yeah.
To say that obviously I would have been disappointed in not being selected for England schools, which I was, but they were wondering if I could report to Wembley and be a ball boy.
Okay.
So I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, fantastic. It was on a Wednesday afternoon, I think, October, And I'm thinking, England and the rest of the world, my God, you know, now here is someone who's your idol, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Russians play.
Yeah.
Now, I was behind his goal in the first half. And I mean, what a display he put on. I mean, he made saves from Jimmy Greaves and Bobby Smith and Bobby Charlton.
Great names, yeah.
And after, he only played first half. So right. I'm standing at the back of the goal. I can remember it. I think it was Greavesy who shot. And the ball went past the goal. And I picked it up and I threw it back to him, you know, as you do your ball
yeah.
for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And threw it back to him. And half time came, and he was sort of looking at me. Well, I thought when he was looking in my direction, I thought he must be looking at somebody else because he didn't know who I am.
No.
He was looking at me and he sort of waved me over.
Okay.
And he gave me his hat and gloves.
Wow. As a souvenir.
Well, I mean, I'm a guy, I've sort of got him.
What are you going gold, Brian?
And I'd never seen these type of goalkeeping gloves before.
Right.
I mean, they were totally black, but they had, you know, like the table tennis bats.
Yes, with like the dimple.
Yeah. Surface. Well, they had that fixed to the fingers.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, I've never seen that. Never seen that in ever. And somewhere in my loft, they're still there.
I was going to ask, do you still have them? I would imagine yeah. you prize them, keep them.
I mean, it's as you saw on the back of the on the book cover, those gloves were the gloves I used in the 71-72, 72-73 season.
Right. And there's a battered, just for listeners, there's a battered pair of gloves. In fact, it was one of the I've asked for questions for you, Brian, and that was one of my questions yeah. actually about gloves. And this is from a friend of mine, Neil Andrews, who runs a goalkeeper's, specific goalkeeper's yeah. website. And he's asked if I can ask you what kind of gloves you used. Were they specific footballers' goalkeeper's gloves? Or
not really. I got them from the Army and Navy stores. And honestly, they were like a string glove.
Well, they looked like gardening gloves or something, looking at them. I mean,
today, I think they would be. But they were three bob a pair. So under the supervision of dear old Jack Blackman, I had to buy a box full. So I had to buy 12. And I think I got a discount on them. But those are the gloves I used the whole of my career.
Wow. And they were from the Army and Navy's, because that was Neil's question. Ask Brian what kind of gloves. Were they driving gloves or gardening gloves or something else?
These were gloves that suited the ball of the day.
Yeah, which was a heavier ball, Brian.
Yes, but there again, I only used gloves when it was wet. Never used them when it was dry.
Oh, so you were barehanded in dry weather. Yeah. You trusted your grip.
Yeah, and you know what? When you're training barehanded at that time, it didn't have to give you a good feel for the ball. And, you know, you can actually feel it sting when it hits your hands, you know. And I think to sing my own praises, but I had a really good. I had a good pair of hands to catch a football cricket ball or whatever. But
I mean, it's a side point. But I was watching football in the week, and I think it was the Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson. I think modern goalkeepers now, Brian. I wanted to get your take because they punch the ball. I suppose the ball is lighter than it would have been in your day, but they seem to punch the ball away rather than catch it. I mean, you're right. You were great. Catcher of the football, you know, it was one of your talents, but it seems to have gone from the game slightly, doesn't it? That idea that goalkeeper.
Well, I think that comes from the way they're coached as well. Ball is totally different to what it was in our day.
Yeah.
But, and it moves around a bit and all these kind of things. But at the end of the day, if you can get it and kill it, and I mean, and kill it, if you can catch it in your body, finish, you know, nothing's going to come from that then because you've got the ball. You know, there's always today, it's always. Keeper pushes it out and they go, what a wonderful save he's made. This, you know, but that's his second save from a straight shot or shot at goal. And okay, sometimes you have to punch and sometimes you can catch. But in our day, not only to be brave, to be able to dive at somebody's feet, of course, people would say you'd be brave, but also decision-making was a brave decision to make. And it was a brave, shall I come, shall I stay? Shall I punch? Shall I catch? You know, do I shout? Do I say nothing? Do I open my mouth? And I can assure you there were many times when I opened my mouth and Kitch said, I wish you hadn't opened your mouth. Because he might be on the end of my knees or my fists, you know.
Well, it was a physical, I mean, it's a physical game still, but it was a much, much more physical game in your time, Brian. I mean, I'm always a bit wary of sounding like, you know, you're kind of waxing lyrical about the old days. And I think to a degree, we'll fall into this trap a little bit. But it was a physical game. The ball was heavier. The pitches were sapping, weren't they?
Pitches were terrible. I mean, and of course, when I started, when a goalkeeper picked up a back pass, he could be barged. You know, the centre forward could come after you and knock you over.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, charge you. Yeah.
And there were a few centre forwards who didn't mind having a charge, by the way.
I was going to ask, did you get charged? I mean,
football? I got an introduction in 67. We played up at Bury Town and they had an ex-Manchester United. It was originally a Busby babe and he went on to play international football and his name was Alex Dawson. Right. A really rugged, tough centre forward. I mean, a good centre forward. And I got a ball knocked back to me and because you're bending down to pick it up. The moment I came up with the ball, he's run straight into me. And if you're stood in the road and the car goes over you, I would imagine it's got similar effect with him. Because
you're flying.
he just seemed to run all the way up me. And as I got up and I could see stud marks, you know, on my arms and on my legs. And he just looked at me and he said, welcome to the real world, son.
Achtung, Mehlball.
I mean, I'm just looking at your photograph. There's a great shot on the front cover of the book here, Brian, where you're doing this kind of like acrobatic, I think it might be Birmingham that you're at.
Yeah, there. It was Birmingham.
Great image. I mean, you were, I'm trying to think of the right words to describe your physical shape. You were slender rather than physically imposing. Yeah. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, you know, I was 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah.
I was pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, which is sometimes they say he's a big tall lad. He might be a bit slow going down, you know. But I seem to be okay in all the departments. I think the biggest disappointment for me, it's not a disappointment, but to be mentioned in the same breath as some of the really great goalkeepers who were around at that time.
Mm.
I mean, and just going back to that England rest of the world game. I mean, the second half I had Gordon Banks, and I was behind his goal and to be able to watch him and then think 5 or 6 years later, I'd be standing opposite him and he's kicking a ball at me and I'm kicking a ball at him.
It was a fantastic photograph on the back cover of the book of yourself next to Banks.
We were with England to, I think it was Malta and Gibraltar to celebrate their centenary. We also had from the World Cup side, there was Terry Payne, who was in the squad.
Fantastic player, yeah.
Nobby Styles, who was in the squad, which made me so sad this week.
Yeah.
Gordon Banks. I think Bobby Charlton was meant to be there, but he'd been injured or something. And there was quite a few good young players, you know, that were with Jerry Francis, Trevor Francis, Frank Worthington, you know. Yeah.
Great names. Some absolute great names.
All big names and... I mean, Nobby was a lovely man, lovely character, great.
I was going to ask, did you meet him? Did you?
Oh, yeah. Of course, you know, played against him when he was at Middlesbrough.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Also, of course, I played with him when we got picked for England and the FA. But he was just a character, I mean... And when you hear and see what's happened to some of these players, I get so upset by it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a serious point, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, obviously, your book is tries to focus on the humorous side of the game, I suppose, but there is a very serious underlying point that the game then, Brian, took a very real physical toll on players generally. There wasn't the medical or support that players get nowadays.
No, there wasn't. You know, how many? I can remember how many times I was injured, and how many times you're expected to play. I mean, have a cortisone injection. Yeah, you'll be all right. You'll be all right. Well, of course.
Yeah.
A cortisone injection, it takes away the pain.
Don't deal with the injury though, does it? It just takes means you can't feel it.
And it comes back, and after that wears off, you're the one who's suffering. But there again, we believe what we were told, and it won't do any harm. It won't do this. It won't do that. But today, you know, I'm 73, and I know I play football.
I imagine you do. I imagine you do. I imagine it catches up with you, Brian, in your latter years. You know.
Yeah, you know, you get up in the morning, and I can't say I actually spring up out of bed in the morning. You know, I'm. I have to make sure I'm functioning from the ankles upwards, really.
I mean, it's funny, but not funny. But one of the things I was a kid when I started going in '72. I was only 12, 11, 12, something like that. And I was always fascinated by Jack Blackman because two things. One was he was clearly the trainer or the medic. I don't know what the description would be in modern game. But his medical kit seemed to be like a bag of water. He had like a rubber bag on him. I don't know what that was.
If he didn't have a bucket, he had the inner tube. It was an inner tube.
Was that what it was?
It was an old bladder, you know. And dear old Jack had he used to have a 10 litre bucket of water. Thank God it wasn't a metal one, but it was a plastic bucket. And he'd always have his sponge in there.
Yeah, a sponge with water. That was the strength of his medical kit, from what I could see, Brian. I mean, you might have seen it more, but that's all it seemed to be.
Well, I saw some of the reasoning with Jack, and obviously football trainers of that era, because I questioned him once because I got a really bad knock on the ankle, and he's come on and he's put this sponge on the back of my neck. And I mean, if you can imagine, okay, it was in a 10-litre bucket of water, but there must have been 5 litres of water in it. So now all of a sudden I'm soaked. And I said to him, Jack, my ankle, why would you put that sponge on my head or on my neck? He'd say, well, there's a theory to that, son. And the theory is the moment that sponge empties his water on you, you stop thinking about your ankle. Which is true in some ways.
Well, I suppose the conversation turns to that rather than your ankle, but I'm not sure it's the greatest medical advice I've ever heard.
Oh, you know, you'll be all right, son. Just keep going. Move your ankle. Run it off. You'll be all right.
Run it off.
But, I mean, he was a lovely man.
Well, say, what a character. I mean, I've written some names down as just to, you know, as to remind myself, really, but each one in their way, Brian, and I probably include yourself as a character. I mean, this was a club full of great characters, Jack Blackman. I mean, I've got Harry Cripps written on him. He was much loved by the crowd, Harry, wasn't he?
Oh, he was much loved by everybody, I think. Harry was I'm not going to say he's a con man, but Harry could always produce things what others needed. But we talk about enthusiasm, and when I watch games today, I feel that some players have got no enthusiasm, but
no.
Harry had bundles of it.
And humour, Brian. I mean, again, another thing that seems to have faded from the game is the laughter that you know, I was agog. I was a kid, like I've said, and I watched him... They had a free kick down near our end of the game, so the direction's going forwards, and the referee's turned his back to run forward. And Harry had this thing of bending down and kind of walking forwards whilst placing the football, so he gained about 5 yards.
Yeah,
and the crowd loved it. They just rolled up laughing.
He was a great character, and as you said, there were many characters in the team. And during my time at Millwall, I played with some really good players.
What kind of bloke was Kitchen, Barry Kitch? I mean, I've never met any of the players. I was a fan. And
I played for Chelmsford City, I played in a tournament at Southend. And we played Millwall. Chelmsford played Millwall. Right. A youth tournament.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until about a few years ago that Wales was looking through the programme when we were putting the book together. And I'm looking at the picture of Millwall. And Kitch is at the front, 17-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the back was Ronnie Els.
Right.
And in my in Chelsea's team, I was in it. There's a boy called Brian Honeywood who went to Ipswich. There's another kid called Graham Pooley who became a league referee.
Right.
And Peter Collins who played for Tottenham.
That's a fantastic array of players, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was a, and that was in 1965.
Yeah.
So 2 years later, we're not only roommates, but we're teammates.
Incredible. That's the journey football can take you on, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah.
Transports your life, you know.
He was an underrated centre half. He was strong, he had left footed. He was a leader of men. He was a lovely, lovely man. And he had a lovely family. I mean, when I went to his funeral in Lowestoft, was it, or somewhere up there?
Yeah, he lived out that way. Yeah.
I spoke at the funeral,
right,
and told a few tales and of our life together in football. And yeah, I can't praise him up enough. Kitt should have played at the top level.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, you know, I know that you went into first division football yourself, but I think, you know, Barry Kitchener and, you know, I suppose it was the thing playing for Millwall, there was a slight unfashionability to it, Brian, wasn't there? So you didn't catch the headlines in quite the same way as Chelsea, Arsenal, I don't know.
No, when you're competing against the Arsenals, the Chelsea's, Tottenham's, who were established first division teams in those days and teams that were winning trophies, of course, for Alf Ramsey to come down the den, you know, was obviously a welcome sight for us.
Yeah.
Because we'd heard we were playing Huddersfield at home. 71, I think it was, he came down just after the World Cup in Mexico. And he came down and you're thinking, I just hope I play well, you know.
Yeah, but, absolutely. What kind of man was Alf Ramsey, Brian? I mean,
another one of those great managers. I mean,
he seemed to have an aura about him. I think, I suppose, the greats do, don't they?
He loved football. He loved footballers.
Yeah.
He didn't take too kindly to directors or people of so-called power in the game.
No.
I mean, as you just said, he had an aura about him, and I remember the first time I met him, I was in awe, and the first thing you say is, "Hello, Sir Alf," and straight away he goes, "No, no, no, please, just Alf."
Just Alf. That's something, isn't it?
He was a player's manager. You know, he'd protect his players, he'd praise his players, and if he told them off, it'd be behind closed doors and in the dressing room.
As it should be.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Achtung, Mehlball.
I mean, overall, looking at the big picture, Brian, I mean, you enjoyed your life at Millwall. Was it?
Oh, yeah. It was,
how do you look back on it now?
Well, when I joined, I didn't know really what to expect. It was a player I was playing with at Chelmsford City, who knew a player at Millwall, and the player at Chelmsford City was Peter Shreves. Managed Tottenham.
Spurs, that's right.
Yeah, and he, again, in the game a long, long time, good footballer.
Yeah.
He was playing for Chelmsford. And after that game against Southend, I spoke to him after Millwall and Tottenham rang me up and saw how I thought about joining either. And he called me up and said, look, I've got a mate of mine plays for Millwall called Ken Jones.
Right.
And he's saying that they sold Alex Stepney.
Yes, they had.
And they've got a keeper who's over 30, he's 32, 33. Scottish international called Laurie Leslie, and of course I'd known the name because of West Ham.
Ex West Ham.
He said, I'll tell you, if you come and you do well, you'll probably get a chance. So I thought about it, and then I got a call at home. We had no mobiles then. And my dad said, there's a Mr. Fenton on the phone. So you know, you could put your hand over the phone then. And he said, who is it? I said, no one, wasn't it? Oh, yeah, then. Have the phone. And, hello, Mr. Fenton. Hello, Brian. He said, I spoke to Chelmsford City, spoke to Harry Ferry, the manager, and I think we've agreed a fee for you.
Right.
Is there any chance I could come down and see you? I said, well, this was either on a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure we could do something on the Thursday. No, he said. No. Can we do something before then? So I said, well, what about tomorrow? He said, what about now?
Right.
So I said to him, well, where are you? He said, I'm in the phone box at the end of your road. Within literally 2 minutes, he was parked outside our house.
Well, he was keen, wasn't he? He was keen. Absolutely.
Well, he told my mum and dad he couldn't sleep after he saw me. I don't know how true that was, but
no. What kind of manager was Benny Fenton? How did he manage his players? Was he?
Tell you what, he could spot a player, not because he caught me, but you look at what he brought to that football club, and think of the money he made for that football club.
Well, he's when you look at his years, and he's there for about 8 years or so, I think, Benny.
9 years, I think. No, it might have been 10 years, actually, because he was, when they went up, when he went up to the second division from the third division, I think he took over then from Billy Gray.
Mid-60s, that's right, yeah. Yeah. And it was, I mean, under Benny, it always seemed to be like this progression. Each year was an improvement, and we were progressing.
Yeah,
towards the season that where it was so nearly in touch, the promotion season.
Well, the season before then, was it, or two seasons before then, we actually, the year Crystal Palace went up.
Yeah.
We were, one stage during the season, we were top of the league then.
Contenders, that's right.
But he had an eye for a player. I mean, Keith Weller.
Well, I was going to, as one of my names I've written on my list here, just to ask about, I mean, you'd played with Keith Weller, Brian, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I never saw him, he was before my time, but all I read is how good he was and what a great player, what a skillful player he was.
Funny, again, it's a funny thing, but while I was at Chelmsford City, we played against Spurs A. They were in the Metropolitan League, Tottenham A, West Ham A, Arsenal A, Colchester, Southend, all their A teams were in that league. And I played against Keith and the POS when I played Chelmsford City Reserves against Tottenham A team. Unbeknown to me, we would be teammates. But again, he was a fringe player at Tottenham, you know, the same as Derek Posse.
Yeah.
Both been in the first team. But what they were competing against at that time, of course, was the Cliff Jones, Jimmy Greaves.
Top players, yeah.
Top players, you know, and they were young players.
Yeah.
So Benny bought them both to the club the same year as I came, they joined.
Right, okay.
And I remember meeting them the first time at the Den when we were doing the photo sessions.
Yeah.
Before the season. But as the season went on, and I was lucky enough to get in the first team quite early, really, that was against Northampton in the League Cup.
Right.
And about a week later, I made my league debut against Blackpool.
And you kind of largely made that position yours over all
yeah, it was
your career, Brian, didn't you?
I was in and out a little bit the first year I was there because he was the first choice goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And having the chance to work with him as a goalkeeper for a year, 14 months, I mean, he's amazing, amazing bloke. And so brave. He weren't the biggest, you know, but Christ, was he ever brave or what?
He was a coach. I mean, again, another name that I know when I started going in the early 70s, Laurie Leslie was on the coaching team, I think.
That's right. But he was a man who I admired as a goalkeeper. And then having the chance to work with him, when I look back, I think he helped me an awful lot to displace himself, really.
Yeah, it's quite selfless, really, isn't it? You know, to do that, to spot talent in a younger player and to bring him through, which, as you say, pushes yourself aside, really.
But then having the chance to play with Keith and the Poss and Dennis Burnett, of course, who was down in the European Cup, Winners' Cup final.
A great defender as well. He's kind of midfield stroke, defensive midfield, I suppose you'd call him in the modern.
I mean, today you, well, I suppose it's a bit of a cliche, but you'd say he was a bit of a Beckenbauer type, really, a bit of a Bobby Moore type.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. And you mentioned Bobby Moore, but I mean, again, he's also mentioned on the book cover.
Yeah.
Did you play with him, or did you met him, I guess.
Together when I was called in to assist with the training with England. If I went there, he'd be there. But I met and played with Bobby in 1966.
Did you? The World Cup? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Now, this will blow your mind, this will, because in May, the first team goalkeeper at Millwall at Chelmsford City was Owen Medlock.
Right.
Again, I've been so lucky with people helping me and good goalkeepers, good ethics.
Yeah.
And he had a testimonial along with a centre half called Terry Eads, who went on to play for Cambridge United and such.
Mm.
But we were planning a testimonial for them in May.
Right.
And in Owens, we had a Chelmsford City All Star team, which was playing against a select 11 from somewhere or other. And we had Jeff Hurst, Peter Braybrook, Bobby Moore, Ken Brown, John Bond, Ronnie Boyce, all these playing in this team. I came on second half. I was, 17 then?
Came on
second half.
Yeah.
I got a ball knocked back to me from Ronnie Boyce. I look up, and who do I throw it to? Bobby Moore.
Wow. What an experience, Brian.
Well, I mean, Christ alive, I'm playing for Chelmsford City, and all of a sudden...
You're in the World Cup winning.
Yeah, and the thing is, we played this game in May.
Yeah.
And in July, he's picking up the World Cup.
Incredible.
Wouldn't happen today. Couldn't happen today.
No, but football was different, I suppose. This is probably a hard question for you, Brian, as you come from that different era. I mean, it must feel like it's a different game almost compared with your day to now. It looks and feels very different, doesn't it, compared with what you experienced.
But I look back at the things that have happened in the game today. I mean, the start of the big match, the start of match of the day, all came through from my era.
Yeah, it did.
And if you look at it and you start to think, well, hang on a minute, we probably opened the door for Sky Television and
absolutely.
BT and everything else.
Absolutely.
We just provided the money for clubs to pay exorbitant wages and exorbitant fees for players. That I don't agree with. I don't agree with a lot of the money going out of the game,
be it
for agents or for foreign players.
No.
I don't agree with that. I don't think there's been enough done to look after the players from the 60s and the 70s.
Well, we see that now, don't we? We see that with the sad stories that we've been seeing.
Yes. When you think World Cup players, and quite a few of them suffer from dementia and Alzheimer's, probably caused by the heading and...
Relentless heading, yeah.
Contact with balls of that era.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think there should have been far more done. Again, we don't begrudge the players. This is a job. It's a short career for some. The things I don't like about it today, obviously, are the social media side of it, which we don't contend with.
No, just as well, I'd say, because it would have been difficult, wouldn't it?
I think some of the things that happened, we might also have made front pages of.
I think you probably might. You have to buy the book to read some of that stuff, though, listeners. I said I wouldn't steal all Brian's best stories. You've got to read the book for that. I'll read that website out again so that people can go and find it. It's called The Lion's King, and the website is www.littlehellbooks.com. Littlehellbooks.com. I will stick a link in the notes when it goes out, 1999. Sorry. I've got a couple of questions. We've done one already about your gloves, Brian. This is another one from Neil as well. He's a goalkeeping website, specialises in goalkeeping. So he's asking about your England's time. Alf Ramsey's last game was Portugal versus England, 1974.
Yeah.
Were you on the bench, or was it Alan Stevenson of Burnley that was on the bench?
Well, it was meant to be the original squad, because you always had three goalkeepers.
Right.
And, I got called in with Alan Stevenson and Phil Parks, and that was originally, and the England FA 11. That was the original time I was called in as the original squad.
Okay.
Because before, when I had to report for, I think they played Malta at home.
Yeah.
I went on a tour as well, an East European tour. As like a replacement for the third goalkeeper.
So you would have been competing with Banks still at that time, wouldn't you?
Well, there was Banks, Benetti. There was Gilton, Clements, Phil Parks, Alan Stevenson, Peter Mellor, Joe Corrigan.
Some great names.
Yeah, I mean, it was an era when goalkeepers were, you know, and I always say, if I get mentioned, Jim Montgomery, yeah. In that group of goalkeepers, then I'm happy with that. Fantastic. I really am. I mean, I know Benny used to go into one about saying I was the top six in Europe and certainly should have played for England. And I was, you know, I think you said it as well. I think, was Millwall glamorous enough, you know, but I thought it was. I thought it was. And as I've said, and I spoke to Gordon Banks about this when Stoke played.
Yeah.
He said, how do you play down there every other week? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I played everywhere in the world, and playing there frightens you to death. I said, well, it did at the start, but it got easier as I got better.
Yeah, I suppose it takes, it's that initial shock. I mean, one of my memories is, especially behind the Coldblow Lane in, Brian, you used to get people, I don't know if you can relate anything that ever got shouted to you, but some of the abuse that would come from the blokes standing there was cutting, to say the least, you know. Well, you had to develop a thick skin, didn't you?
Well, to be honest, you don't really hear it. All you hear is that there was an amazing engine of noise that seemed to generate down the
old.
And as much as I love the new den, I think if you played at the old den, whether you're an away team or a home team, I mean, they always talk about the 12th man and this carry on, but I've played there when there's been 7,000-8,000 people in the ground.
When
there's been over 35,000 in the ground.
Yeah.
And the noise they generate, it is very, very similar to the way the Icelandic team supporters responded to their team
in the World Cup,
in the European Championship.
Oh, the European Cup, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, in this, they have this clap and this noise they make. Well, I'm sure all that generated from Millwall.
Generates a unique kind of sense of energy, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we never knew. No one likes us, we don't care.
No.
In those days, but it was a ground which it wasn't an attractive ground to have to drive to.
That's a good way to put it. That's very diplomatically put, Brian.
And it was also, once you got to the ground, it made you swallow to realise what you were going into, because a visiting team would have to walk across that car park.
Yes.
There was always a few lively chaps out there. And then down that little sort of tunnel way,
yeah,
dressing room, where The room in front of the dressing room was packed with policemen. We had a commander there who was in charge of all this lot. Commander Dave West, I think his name was. Lovely man. Lovely man. Took us and showed us the Black Museum at Scotland Yard. And
oh, right. You went to see that? Yeah.
You know, these things where you'd never be able to get entry in those days, but...
No.
Arranged these things and showed us around Scotland Yard. And, you know, all those things enhance you growing up, don't they, really?
Character building, I suppose you'd say.
I've always wanted to, you know, the bath that Christie used to get rid of his bodies in was very similar to the one that was in the
one for the older listeners there to get that reference. I make you right though. I think that is a good
It was a big old iron, big old iron bath. It was, Jesus Christ. That's what I'm not getting in there.
I've got another question. One last question from listeners. Well, Glenn Schimmel has messaged me too. So, question for Brian King. The goalkeeper's position is always evolving and changing, he says. So what do you, Brian, see as the most important attribute for any young Millwall goalkeeper to have? Psychological, technical, tactical, physical? You know, what advice would you give a Millwall goalkeeper particularly? Because it is a tough environment at times down there, isn't it?
It's a very tough environment, and which leads you to the fact that one of the things in my day they used to say, goalkeepers were crazy because they always looked as though they were patrolling their penalty box and talking to themselves. And only nutcases talk to themselves. But it was a form of keeping your concentration and keeping your attention on the game in front of you, which you had to have, especially playing at the Old Den. I mean, as you say, if you were to let your ears pick up everything that was coming, and some of it was funny, and some of it was horrible, but the majority of it for Millwall players, as long as you gave 100%, you'd get 100% from the people who were watching you. And for a young goalkeeper today, I think his concentration has to be up there with anything required for a goalkeeper today, and especially the game today where the ball and the goalkeeper has to use his feet far more than I did.
Yeah.
Although I used to play out at least once a week, either up front or somewhere on as an outfield player, and I think that's what they do now. But a lot of goalkeeper work is done around your feet, and don't take chances. I mean, if there's an easy solution, then use it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I don't envy a goalkeeper today because it's not just put the ball on the six-yard line and look for a short goal kick, or you boot it over the halfway line. Today, you have two full-backs that want to drop into the penalty area and take the ball off you. Personally, I can't see the reasoning in that, because you're opening yourself up to be put under pressure in your
box,
your third of the, you know, your defensive third of the field. And
I agree.
I'm not too keen on that, but and you see how many goalkeepers take chances. All of a sudden, a goalkeeper thinks he can play.
Well, if you keep taking chances, you'll make errors, Brian, won't you? You know, it just happens. It's got to.
The Millwall goalkeepers I've seen since I finished there. I mean, Paul Sanson and Peter Glazier, Brian Horn.
Yep.
Tony Warner, Casey Keller.
Yep.
Who else are we going under? David Ford.
Well, I think also our current goalkeeper, the Polish Bartosz, Bill Kosky, very good goalkeeper.
He looks a good goalkeeper. He's got the size. He makes some good saves. He makes match winning saves, but he's also. He's also made a few mistakes, as we all have.
Yeah.
But I haven't really seen enough of him to be critical or praise him. But what I've heard, he seems a nice fella, and he works hard at his game, and I can only wish him well, really, but as I do the team, Whenever it's the first result I always look for.
I was going to ask, do you still follow the Lions? I know you're based in Norway now, but you still follow the Lions from...
Yeah, of course. And, you know, when I've been back, I've been lucky enough to be presented on the pitch when I was 60.
Yeah.
I was presented on the pitch
when I was
70.
Yeah.
And I was down there quite recently when the posh was over.
Yeah.
There was a picture of me, Georgie Jacks, Billy Neal and the posh on the pitch, which I treasure. You know, it's as I've said many times, when I went on the pitch, I think Phil Walker was with me.
Yeah, great player. And we
were both presented with these cut glass footballs to represent that we were regarded as legends for the club. When I walked on that pitch, and I think there's about 15 or 16,000 people there, I'm looking back and I'm thinking, I haven't been on this football pitch as a player or anything really since 75.
Yeah, when you left, yeah.
And now all of a sudden, it's 2007 and hang on a minute here, you know, look at all these people standing up, kids, men, grandfathers, fathers, grandfathers, and I'm walking out and I'm thinking, Jesus, how humble can this make you?
And how
pleasing it was to think that these people held me in that kind of esteem.
That's really nice stuff, Brian.
I was honoured. And,
yeah,
you know, I know my family was there as well. And I look back at that and I look at the pictures in my office from that day and I take a deep breath and think how lucky I was to give these supporters who I grew to love. You know, and I look back and I think, okay, I went into the first division. I wasn't lucky enough. I got a bad injury and stuff. But I think if I'd have stayed at Millwall, I'd have played 1,000 games.
I mean, you know, the name Brian King still... It resonates as in the way you've just described so well. I think it's a measure of the career that you had there and the esteem in which you remain held at the football club.
You know, I look back and think when the PFA brought out these all-star teams.
Yeah.
And I think then of the goalkeepers I was competing for to be picked in an all-star team.
Oh, you're up against, well, we said it already, we're up against some of the major names in the sport, in the game.
Phil Parks.
Absolutely. Great goalkeeper.
Stepney,
yeah.
Jimmy Montgomery.
Yeah.
You know, and I look back at those teams that were selected and I think, Jesus, that's me in goal for that team.
It's quite something, isn't it? Quite something. I said I wouldn't steal any of your funny stories because they're all in the book and we want people to buy the book, Brian. So I don't want to nick any of your funny stories. But is there one favourite story to close us that you can share with the listeners? Just one that maybe you choose your fave.
I suppose it was a time when we played West Brom away and I got a nasty kick in the face.
Right.
I've gone for a corner and... I got my hands on the corner, a couple of bodies in front of me, and to be fair, I should have punched it. Ball dropped down, and as I dived on it, dear old Jeff Astle, a name that's been brought up many times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And again, this is one of the causes and one of the things that I want to try and fight before I leave this earth.
Right.
For that kind of injury, that kind of sickness. And I got a nasty kick in the face from Jeff Astle. And I lost a couple of teeth. And I got a nasty cut on the lip.
You've been bashed up badly there.
Well, I suppose some people would say it's been a typical Saturday night for some people. But no, I got in the dressing room and a bit shook up. And Jack had already, I'd already had the sponge on my head and face. So the blood was dispersed. And they went and got the club doctor, and he proceeded to have a look at my face and things. And dear old Benny was the first thing Benny said to me was, "If you'd have caught it, you wouldn't have got kicked." So There was a sympathetic word from the manager to make you feel better, which, and hey, at the end of the day, it's the truth.
I mean, if I had a harsh, call, it's harsh but true, I'll give you that.
It doesn't give you a time whether to reflect on whether the boot that kicked you was Puma or Adidas or Polar or whatever. But I'm laying on the table, the doc comes in, Benny said, make that quick, put some stitches in there, make it quick. And he started to stitch me lip. And I mean, if you've ever had anything around there without an anesthetic on,
it's painful.
I'm pretty sure. And after about three stitches, I said to him, Doc, you've got to stop. You've got to stop, Doc. He said, I thought you goalkeepers were brave. So I said to him, but you've got to stop. He said, why? I said, because you've sewn my tongue to my lip. And that's what he done. So now Benny said, for God's sake, get out. Do it after the game. He said, give him a brandy. I had a little brandy. He said, rinse your mouth out. So I took a swig of this dear old Jack's medical help. Brandy, rinsed my mouth out. And I'm thinking, do I spit it out? I'll have it all.
Like dentists.
All I need is a referee to say, you've been drinking.
Oh, dear.
You know, that was... And then afterwards, when we come back in, I'm not sure whether Doc had forgot about it, but I had this bit of a lip. It was in April because we were going to have a dinner party for your birthday.
Right.
When I got back from West Brom and I drove from the Den back home to where I was living outside Chelmsford. The missus was at the door and she thought to Quasimodo or two.
Oh dear, wonderful, wonderful but, stuff.
And now, of course, everything's come together, and I've got to thank Mark Howarth who helped me write the book, or he wrote the book, and from my tales, done a great job. A lovely, lovely man. And dear old Jim Murray.
Absolutely.
Who's a Millwall fanatic and historian.
Yep.
And his people who helped put the book together, Vinny and Jane, all done a great job. I mean, far, far, far more than what probably I deserve, but it looks the part. The book looks the part, and I just hope as many Millwall people can shell out the money for it. Or
absolutely, it's leading up to Christmas. It's an ideal gift for Christmas.
Yeah. I keep thinking when people say, when I go to the Den, and somebody comes up, young boy, 10 or 11, is, can I have your autograph, please? And always sign an autograph, you know.
Yeah.
Because some of the great managers in the game, I've heard them say this thing, never walk away from a child or a person who wants your autograph, because there's going to be a time in your career when they ain't going to ask you.
Well, that's the truth, isn't it?
And to be fair, I've always tried to accommodate. But the last time I was at the Den last year and the boy came up, he said, I heard you was a good goalkeeper. So I said, well, you're too young to have seen me. He said, no, but my granddad said you was good.
That's
and
nice.
I think, well, that's lovely, you know. And if I give them, Millwall supporters, that thought about me, then I'm happy.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Brian. It really is, mate. I started the conversation by saying that I was a boy watching you at the Den, and to be able to speak to you now is a real privilege. Never thought it would come in my life, so it's great to be able to speak to you, and it's a wonderful career. You gave so much to the club, and as I've said before, you're held in very high esteem at the Den. So this is a wonderful book for Lions fans. It's called The Lions King. It's available for $19.99 at www.littlehellbooks.com. I will stick a link in the show notes for this. Wonderful stuff. And it's come, as Brian says, come from the James Murray Publishing House. I'm a huge fan of James Murray's and the Lions of the South book that he produced all those years ago. So it's going to be a good one. So We'll repeat a few adverts for this. So I'm going to make no apology, listeners. I'm going to repeat a few adverts of Brian's book over the forthcoming shows. Brian King, pleasure to talk to you, mate, again. We must do this more often. We'll speak again at some time.
Nick, now that we've mastered the Zoom calls, we seem to be up and running.
Oh, just to explain to listeners, I wasn't sure whether Brian would have heard of Zoom. This is always a tentative conversation, Brian, when you're speaking to somebody you don't know and you don't want to presume too much. Equally, you don't want to make them sound like they don't know anything. So we finally reached Zoom, and this is wonderful reception and wonderful stuff. So I really appreciate your time this morning, Brian. Thank you.
Well, I'm very appreciative that you think of me, and I'm very thankful that the way that you're approaching and putting the book out there. And I also have as much respect for you people, the Millwall supporters and the people who do these podcasts and radio shows. So I'm always around. At this difficult time, as we say.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
People can't move around and the different podcasts and, I have quite a good group of friends who I talk to quite regularly. Ex-players, Ian Atkins,
Jim
Reeves, Steve Perriman, Joe Royal, John Gregory.
Yeah, good names.
All good ex-footballers, footballers.
Football men, yeah, absolutely. Wonderful stuff. Really appreciate your time, Brian. Thank you very much, mate.
Good luck to you, Nick, and good luck to the Lions.
Up the Lions.
Up the Lions.
Thank you for listening to Achtung Millwall. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a cheeky little review. However, to Achtung Millwall. Till next time.